It's Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, when you think about mummies, you probably think of Egypt and King Tut. But Gemma Tarlak of Discover Magazine tells us there are mummies all over the world, and a lot of them are women.
First, Governor Scott Walker announced last week he was talking with President Trump's administration about adapting Act 10 for federal employees.
Act 10, which was implemented amid widespread protests here in Wisconsin back in 2011, sharply curtailed collective bargaining rights for state employees. Among other things, it restricts state employees' ability to bargain for better working conditions, limits pay increases, and requires them to pay more for their health insurance and pension plans.
Governor Walker said he met with Vice President Mike Pence recently to discuss which parts of Act 10 could be adopted by the federal government. Here's his account of the meeting.
We've talked about what we've done here in Wisconsin, how they might take bits and pieces of what we did with Act 10 and with civil service reform and how they could apply to that at the national level.
Patrick Marley joins us now. He covers state government and politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's the co-author with fellow reporter Jason Stein of More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions, and the Fight for Wisconsin. Patrick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
You point out in your article that the first 2 weeks of the Trump administration seems eerily reminiscent of what happened in Wisconsin in 2011. Can you draw some similarities for us?
Yeah, there's a lot of parallels there. I mean, when Governor Walker was elected within a month, he introduced what became Act 10, and that resulted in these massive protests, you know, the biggest that Madison had seen since the Vietnam era, and there were protests elsewhere in the state. Of course, the day after Trump was elected, we saw this women's march that was very large in Washington, D.C., very large in Madison, I think the biggest protest in Madison since Act 10. And then you've seen a little bit of the Democrats in the U.S. Senate skipping meetings to try to block nominations. That has some resemblance to the state senators leaving the state for 3 weeks to try to stop Act 10.
Yeah, so those are some of the similarities. Well, looking at in 2011, Walker and Republicans in the legislature, they pushed to limit collective bargaining for public workers. What moves are you seeing at the national level that indicate the federal government could gain traction on weakening unions?
Well, Governor Walker said that he met, as you had that clip, met with Mike Pence, talked about it, said Mike Pence was interested in doing Act 10 at a national level. Now, there's some significant differences between public sector unions in Wisconsin and, or at least the way they were constructed before Act 10 and at the federal level. In Wisconsin, before Act 10, they had full bargaining rights. Federal employees, by and large, cannot bargain over their wages, but they can bargain over other things like workplace safety and those kinds of things. That could all be withdrawn if Congress and Trump are so inclined.
Well, let's hear a clip now of Governor Walker and what he could say is using parts of Act 10 to limit collective bargaining. Here's what his outlines his motivation.
It's something that they're interested in. The vice president's brought up before. Newt Gingrich, former Speaker Gingrich, has brought it up multiple times. Others have. Certainly something we're willing to offer our assistance on, particularly if it helps improve not just the nation, but in turn helps improve the ability to be better stewards of taxpayers' dollars here in Wisconsin.
So, Patrick Marley, what do you see that's in this for Governor Walker?
I don't know if what specifically would be in it for the governor, other than it would maybe burnish his image a little more nationally. If the members of Congress were wanting to go along with this, they could look to Wisconsin as a model, and he could say that he led the way there. I think he would like having that kind of reputation.
We're talking with Patrick Marley, who covers state government and politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're looking at parallels between Act 10 policy and protests in Wisconsin and what's going on at the federal level. As you mentioned, last week we saw U.S. senators boycotting committee meetings to try to block approval of two of Trump's nominees. And this move has rekindled that memory of Wisconsin Democrats who fled the state in 2011 in that effort to stop implementation of Act 10. Do you think those actions ultimately will be helpful or harmful to Democrats?
Well, that is the great question. That's why I wrote this story, because a lot of the protests against Trump have been compared to sort of the mirror image of the Tea Party. You know, when Obama was elected, a year later they enacted the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, and you started seeing this outpouring of opposition, people showing up at a bunch of congressional meetings, raising questions, and of course, 2 years later, 2010 was a very good year for Republicans. So there's been sort of this national comparison to what's happening now and asking, is this the Democratic version of the Tea Party? And that may be the case. I mean, we don't know. It's also possible that it is more like Act 10 the response to Act 10, in that there's this early opposition and many people speaking out and protesting and getting involved in the political process, but then being unsuccessful at the ballot box. Of course, the Democrats had a couple of victories with recalls of state senators, but ultimately did not change the, I mean, they briefly flipped the Senate, but at a time when they were out of session, it didn't matter. So the legislature today remains in Republican hands. They held this election, this recall election for Governor Walker. He won that and then went on to win re-election. So despite that early energy, it was not very useful to Democrats in terms of the ability to get their policies in place.
And we've drawn the similarities between the current protests we're seeing at the national level and these 2011 protest actions here in Wisconsin. Talk a little bit about some the dissimilar things about what's going on here between Wisconsin and what's going on nationally.
I talked to U.S. Representative Mark Pocan, who was in the state legislature at the time, and he made the point that Act 10 was a fight that was over one issue. It was this collective bargaining of public sector employees, which is very important to teachers and other public workers and their families and other people who might know them, important to private sector unions, but to many voters didn't have a lot of resonance for them, especially when you have the election more than a year after the policy is enacted. These protests that we're seeing now are over many other issues. You know, you had the Women's March, which was really billed as a women's march, but many issues were raised in those protests. I don't think they had an overriding theme. You had this response to the immigration ban and these spontaneous protests at airports. You've had this response to at the legislative level, I think you've seen a big response to Betsy DeVos and the Democrats hoping that they could get a final vote to prevent her. And so Pocan's comment was that this Act 10 was a single issue. This is a single guy. It's sort of this response to Trump. And so I really think, you know, how the 2018 elections go are going to depend on what the public's perception of the president is.
But are there lessons from Act 10 in Wisconsin that we might see Republican politicians applying at the national level?
Yeah, I think both sides have lessons to learn from Act 10. You know, the Republicans learned that they can power through controversy. You know, that there were at the early stages of Act 10, it looked like they were in pretty grave danger, that they could really lose a lot of members through recalls, that for a time it wasn't even clear if they were going to be able to pass Act 10. And they found that they could stick together, they could generate their base, that the Dem base was the one that first got very focused on this issue. They were able to transfer that energy or get their base as excited about it and generate fundraising and excitement about the issue nationwide. Don't undercut the fact that Reince Priebus is, was involved in that fight. He's now chief of staff to the president. Paul Ryan witnessed all that as a member of the congressional delegation from Wisconsin.
And finally, Governor Walker didn't endorse President Trump during the election, but started supporting him after he got the nomination. And now he says he'll help him apply Act 10 on a federal level. Do you see this alignment with the Trump administration and lending a hand via Act 10? Will this influence Governor Walker's future in politics?
Well, it's going to certainly have an effect on Governor Walker's reelection campaign. I mean, it looks like he's going to run for re-election. He hasn't formally announced. But after a year of keeping his distance from Trump, you know, first by saying he wanted Trump to be defeated as the nominee when Walker dropped out of the race for president, and then endorsing Trump, Ted Cruz, and then finally coming around to Trump, now he's embraced the president and So, again, if Trump is popular in 2018, that will be very good for Scott Walker. If Trump's numbers are very low, the Democrats will be painting Walker as a tool of the president, and that will hurt him in the election.
Patrick, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
That was Patrick Marley, who covers state government and politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to look at parallels between Act 10 policy and protests in Wisconsin with what's going on right now at the federal level.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, our guest says President Trump's foreign policy actions could take the world back to the 1930s with serious risks to the U.S. and beyond.
Right now, when you hear the word mummy, you probably think of Egypt and maybe the most famous mummy in the world, King Tut. But cultures all over the world had their own systems of mummification, and a lot of the mummies are actually women.
Gemma Tarlak joins us now to talk about some of these mummies. They're dubbed Eternal Princesses in the latest issue of Discover magazine. She's a senior editor at Discover based in Waukesha, and she joins us once a month to share some cool science news. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So Eternal Princesses, who are these leading ladies?
Well, it's really fascinating because, mummies are everywhere. We usually associate them, as you said, with Egypt and maybe a couple other spots, but really they're found on almost every continent. And as you mentioned, a lot of them are women. So we looked at five of the most diverse of the lady mummies out there. And just to kind of introduce people to the different cultures and different time periods in which they lived. And, we've got, for example, Lady Di. She was the wife of a provincial nobleman in the 2nd century BC in the Han Dynasty in southern China. And she was buried with, the food she liked to eat, like her favorite meals and changes of clothing and all these really excesses from her luxurious life. And it was actually her luxurious life that led to her early death at the age of 50. She was a little too fond of rich things and sitting around in luxurious silks.
She had high cholesterol and a heart attack, apparently.
Yeah, they found that she had high cholesterol and diabetes and high blood pressure, and they think that, just based on the condition of her internal organs, that she overindulged, had a few too many swans. Swans were one of the foods found with her, and had a heart attack and died. And really the interesting thing about her body is that they actually, the Chinese researchers who found her, were able to perform an autopsy on her because her skin is still pliable. Yeah, there's still blood in her veins. So it's a fascinating example of the different ways mummies are actually preserved.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, mummies in ancient Egypt, there's this huge ritual and process for doing it on purpose. As I understand it, some mummies just sort of happened by atmospheric conditions or whatever. Lady Di from the Han Dynasty here, was she mummified on purpose?
Oh, yes. In fact, from what we can see, not only in her body, but also in the way she was mummified, she was wrapped in multiple layers of silk, and she was placed in four nested coffins, one, inside the other. And they found traces of things like mercury in those coffins, which suggests that the toxic metal may have been used as an antibacterial. But, basically, it wasn't really what was done to her to mummify her. She lasted this long in this great shape because those coffins created a hermetic environment. So, for example, the Egyptian mummies, their procedures involved a lot of actual preservation of the organs intentionally, basically soaking them in solutions of different chemicals, where that was a very different situation than Lady Di, who it was just the airless environment. It didn't allow any bacteria in to destroy the tissues.
Well, what about some other mummies around the world? Who are these other people who had been so well preserved?
Sure. Well, we've got the Siberian Ice Maiden, and she's a fascinating figure. She's more than 2,000 years old and from sort of the edge of Siberia and China. And she had gorgeous tattoos on her body that have been preserved, and they think she was a young woman, probably about 30 at most, and it looks like she may have died from breast cancer, and that's based on MRIs. They're able to do, you know, an assortment of medical screening and scanning on these bodies, and they're finding things like abnormal tissue growth that they think may have been a malignant tumor. They could also tell that the Siberian Ice Maiden fell probably from her horse, because she was part of a horse culture. She fell from her horse and injured her right hip and shoulder, and they think that she may have been kind of lingering on in pain for months before she finally passed, and that she may have actually been using cannabis to ease her pain. So they can find a lot of different things by looking at the tissues, scanning, doing chemical analysis on the hair. All the modern medical methods that we apply, they can apply these to these mummies that are thousands of years old.
That's amazing. So this is giving us a lot more information than just if we had a skull and some teeth or something like that, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. When you look at some of the others, for example, La Doncella of the Andes, they could tell that she was found more than 22,000 feet above sea level, and they can actually tell that before her death, her diet changed. It became much richer, and she also began to imbibe this special ritual beer, and they think that's because months before she actually died, she was chosen to become this very important sacrifice to the gods. And so once she was chosen, her diet changed, everything about her changed, because she was being prepared to become basically an intermediary between humans and gods. So tons of fascinating stuff they can find. And culturally, too, just what they're buried with, what they're dressed with. The mummies just, you know, our writer, Nate Sharping, had a great comment that these mummies really become ambassadors for their culture and for their time, because they tell us so much that we can't get from just a skeleton.
And Gemma, before we move on from mummies, I was just in shock about self-mummification and just how Buddhist monks would go about this procedure of DIY, do-it-yourself mummification, and also the other forms of mummification that are more natural. Can you talk about those as well?
Sure, sure. Well, in addition to the hermetic environment that Lady Di was in, there's also just freezing, especially at high altitude, and that's what happened to La Doncella. There's also just desiccation, just being in an extremely dry desert environment. And also there are, you know, you may have heard of the bog bodies in Europe. Peat bogs are naturally anaerobic environments. There's no oxygen, so there's no reason really for bacteria to be there. So if the body is submerged in a peat bog, it can also be naturally mummified. But yeah, you mentioned the self-mummification, and that was practiced hundreds of years ago, mostly in Japan, by these Buddhist monks who for a decade would eat nothing but tree bark and pine needles, which have kind of natural desiccants in them to... It's hard to talk about, but basically like dry themselves from the inside out, and they would slowly starve. And, you know, if you want your mummy to last a long time, go on a diet before you die, because fat is one of the first tissues to break down and attract microorganisms. So if you're super skinny, you're already at an advantage to leave a mummy that's going to last a long time.
And so they would go on this decade-long extreme diet, and then at the end, they would bury themselves alive?
Yeah. It was this insane process where, well, I shouldn't say insane, but it was an intense process. Let's just say that they basically would bury them, get into this like wooden box that had a bell in it, and the other monks would listen for the bell every morning, and then if the bell didn't ring anymore, they would be like, okay, he's gone, and then just actually close things up and put the rocks on top of the coffin and such. So it was a very, very intense process. And yeah, there are a few surviving examples of these mummies, surviving in the sense that we still have the bodies. And they're in Japan and in a variety of places where sometimes people go and make pilgrimages even to the bodies. But they don't do that anymore, I should say.
On that cheery note, we're talking to Gemma Terlak from Discover Magazine. Well, let's perk things up, Gemma, and try to figure out how the universe is going to end. We know the beginning,
yes.
Big Bang, expansion, whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. People are putting together theories on how, if it will end. What do we know?
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, it's not what we know, it's what we don't know, so we're trying to theorize. And we do know that the universe kicked off about 13.8 billion years ago. And they're looking at, we know that the universe continues to expand. And in fact, they're pretty sure that the expansion is, the rate of expansion is speeding up. What's going to happen? And so there are all these different theories. One of the main ones is called the Big Rip, and that is just that the universe keeps expanding until it basically pulls itself apart. Don't worry, though, that's not going to happen for about another 22 billion years. So we'll all be mummies at best if then. But then another theory is the Big Freeze, and that's the idea that, you know, the universe is expanding and it's not going to pull apart, but eventually things are going to become so far apart from each other that, for example, light from other galaxies, stars, won't reach our planet. Of course, our sun's going to go away before then, so you don't have to worry. But, you know, black holes will evaporate. Matter itself will just decay into radiation, and the universe basically turns into a cold, lightless, lifeless place. This is just a really fun, upbeat segment, and I apologize for that. But yeah, so that's another theory. And then, of course, to me personally, the scariest theory is the false vacuum, and that's just that we think our universe is pretty stable. We think we've got a handle on the rate of expansion, et cetera. But what if I told you our universe is just this, like, tiny outpost within a larger multiverse?
Whoa.
And basically, yeah, oh, wait, it gets worse. So the researcher, one of the researchers involved in this theory, thinks that basically if you could imagine our universe as a bubble in a pot of boiling water, well, what happens to those bubbles in the boiling water? Eventually, they start colliding with each other. And there are some scientists to think that that could happen to our universe at any time. Our little bubble of a universe could just collide with another universe, and let me just say that would be a very, very bad day because we have no idea what would happen when they combine, but it won't be good.
Well, really, really quickly here, Gemma, do you think we'll know the answers to how the universe will end in our lifetimes? What's the timeline for figuring this out?
You know, that's a good question. Some of the theories that were advanced 10, 20 years ago, they've already been discounted as not possible. And the big key is learning more about dark energy. It's, you know, it's nearly 70% of our universe, and we know very little about it. We've never even documented that it exists for real. So if we can kind of pin dark energy down and figure out what its role is in the expansion of the universe, we have a much better chance of understanding how the universe is actually evolving.
I'll work on that after the show. Gemma, thanks a lot for joining us, as always.
Always a pleasure. Take care.
That was Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about some of the coolest science headlines.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a foreign policy expert who's worried about what he's seen so far from the Trump administration. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, a 2008 law gave rape victims more access to emergency contraception. We'll find out why some Wisconsin hospitals didn't follow it.
First, in his opening weeks in the White House, President Trump has made a lot of waves in foreign policy. The TPP trade agreement is out. His plans for a wall with Mexico are starting to take shape, and a travel ban on people from seven countries and a halt to the refugee program have gotten global reaction. Plus, the president has stuck with his positive words for Russian President Vladimir Putin, gotten into tiffs with the leaders of Mexico and Australia, and made NATO leaders nervous as well.
Our next guest says that, taken as a whole, the president's actions look like they're part of an overall comprehensive strategy that would mark a major break with the recent past. And he says that strategy would take the world back to the dangerous era of the 1930s, on the eve of the Second World War.
Jeremy Suri joins us now. He's the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs and Professor of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He's co-editor of The Power of the Past, History and Statecraft. Jeremy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
You wrote just over a week ago, quote, "Trump's executive orders are the blueprints for the most significant shift in American foreign policy since the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in December 1941. What do you see taking shape?
Well, since that terrible moment in 1941, the United States has pretty consistently embraced the notion that we have to be part of an international system where we rely on and support allies and where we build institutions and rules for the behavior of countries. We have believed that our power is most useful for us when it is tamed by a system of law and alliances. And I think Donald Trump is very intentionally tearing that apart. He doesn't believe in international law. He doesn't believe in alliances. And he doesn't believe really in long-term international cooperation. It's a very unilateralist, isolationist policy symbolized by walls and threatening rhetoric toward people.
So a world that looks like the 1930s, every country for itself in a way, what would that look like today?
Well, that would be, I think, a terribly dangerous world, and it would be a world where many, many people, particularly those who are in struggling circumstances, will suffer much more, because that kind of world will be a world of higher tariffs and therefore higher cost for things we buy. It'll be a world of less economic growth because it will tear apart many of the markets that produce more jobs and more activity for us, and it will be a world of more conflict, not less, and more conflict for the United States than we've had in the past.
Well, let's put another view on this, and maybe one that inspired a lot of people to support Donald Trump's foreign policy. The things you're talking about, the alliances, they're nice, but the costs of maintaining this world order through these supporting these institutions and our military presence around the world, they've exceeded the benefits to the U.S., and we're picking up too much of the tab. What do you say to that?
I just don't think there's a foundation for that. I know some people perceive it that way, but there's just no foundation for that. In fact, the United States has received a very, very, very good deal from the international expenditures that we have undertaken for the world, especially through international organizations. We have opened markets for our products. We have acquired and consumed more than anyone else. The average American consumes three times as much as the average Chinese citizen does, let alone someone in Africa or elsewhere. And although we have been involved in many conflicts, the average American has not been directly touched by these conflicts. The problems we've had, Rob, have been inequality within our society. We have benefited enormously from these international interactions, but we have not shared the benefits within our society. And I think that's the issue that's getting mistaken for the international issues.
Right. The president's been making the case that trade agreements as they stand have been the cause for inequality, for a particular suffering, especially in certain factories, so-called Rust Belt communities. Do you see some element of truth to that story?
I see the perception of that. But the historian in me, Rob, says that economic change is an ongoing process, and the last thing you want to do is try to stay locked in the past. We have always had, with each generation, changes in the workforce, changes in the skills required. In the 19th century, you didn't need a high school degree to get a good paying job. By the mid-20th century, you needed a high school degree. Today, you need a college degree. This is a natural transformation in the nature of the economy. And the problem we have is that many citizens, and I understand why they're upset, are having trouble keeping up. They're having trouble keeping up not because of economic change. They're having trouble keeping up because we're not doing enough for education. We're not doing enough for retraining of workers. We're not doing enough in our social welfare net to give people a chance to catch up with change. The change is not faster than it's really been. It's our inability to adjust to it. That's the problem.
Talking to Jeremy Suri, historian at the University of Texas, Austin, looking at President Trump's foreign policy in his first couple weeks in office. I want to get to some specific issues. Jeremy, NATO, President Trump talked today at a military base. He has said he's called NATO obsolete in the past, but today he was saying, you know, NATO's great. We just wanted to pay its fair share. The U.S. is picking up too much of the tab. What do you make of what we've heard from the president on this key alliance?
Well, I'm glad that his rhetoric on NATO is changing. I think he is getting educated, and I think we need to give him credit and his advisors a credit for paying attention to these issues and listening to what our allies say. What I think the president is realizing is that NATO is the most successful alliance in the history of the world. It doesn't mean it's perfect, but it does a crucially important job of providing security and stability for the largest markets that we work with in the world, which are in the Western Hemisphere and Western Europe, and particularly particularly in Western Europe. So this is a very important part of our security and economic stature. Now, the United States definitely does pay more money into NATO, but we are in command as well, and we have always wanted to be in command. And the challenge will be, if we really want our allies to pay more and we want them to get involved more, we will have to share decision-making with them. And one of the problems is that I believe the president has been talking about NATO more as a protection racket rather than as an alliance, where we protect them and they pay us to protect them. That's not the way an alliance works. An alliance works through cooperation. And the deal we've made in the past has been that we have more political authority in NATO than anyone else in return for doing a little more than everyone else. If we want to renegotiate, that's fine, but we're going to have less political authority then.
On a related note, there's been a lot of talk about Donald Trump's attitude toward Russia and Vladimir Putin. Here he is this weekend, the president talking to Bill O'Reilly from Fox News.
Will I get along with him? I have no idea.
He's a killer, though. Putin's a killer.
A lot of killers. We got a lot of killers. Why, you think our country's so innocent?
Been a lot of reaction to that statement in particular, Jeremy, but can you talk about what you're seeing now that he is not the president-elect, but the president in Donald Trump's attitudes toward Putin and Russia?
I think, Rob, here again, we have to give Donald Trump some credit. We do see at least some change in his rhetoric on Putin. He seems far less committed to the personal relationship that he believed he could have, and he seems to recognize that there are areas of tension, at the very least, between the United States and Russia, and certainly areas of tension between Russia and many of our allies in Europe, particularly Germany. So I think there is some shifting here, but we haven't yet, maybe we will soon, but we haven't yet heard from him a real coherent explanation of what our policy should be toward a country that has invaded and annexed an area in Crimea, a country that is responsible for supporting genocide in Syria, and a country that is that hacked our elections and has been undertaking cyber warfare in our own country and is doing this in Europe right now. What we need is less talk from the president about whether he likes Vladimir Putin or not, and more talk about a coherent policy for us to pursue.
And in the Wall Street Journal, there's an article about people being perplexed over a new White House statement committed toward restoring peace on the border between Russia and Ukraine. A lot of people in the article pointing out that the problem isn't on the border, it's within Ukraine itself. Are you seeing a grasp on a complicated issue like that coming from the new administration?
No, not yet. Maybe it's too early. To be fair, these are incredibly complex issues, but there are real facts here. Putin has been, the Russian leadership has been undertaking a low-scale war in Ukraine, sending its forces in different uniforms, sending them under cover into Ukraine, and there are Ukrainian forces that we have traditionally supported who have been fighting against that and are worried that they're going to lose their support in the United States. Whether we should continue supporting those Ukrainian forces or not is open to debate, but we should have some clarity on this issue. It's not a border issue. This is an issue of Russian warfare in Ukraine, and we have to decide what our position is on that.
Jeremy Suri is with us, history professor at the University of Texas, Austin. He says President Trump's foreign policy is putting the world at risk of a return to the 1930s era on the edge of potential future calamities.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of President Trump's statements and policies so far on Russia, on trade barriers, or on a wall with Mexico and targeting seven countries to restrict travel to the U.S.? Do you think he's headed in the right direction or putting the world at risk? You can call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We continue our conversation with historian Jeremy Suri from the University of Texas, Austin. He says President Trump's foreign policy moves are taking the world back to the dangerous era of the 1930s.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of what you've seen from President Trump and his administration when it comes to foreign policy? Are you worried that he's making the world a more dangerous place, or do you see him making good calls in the interest of the United States? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Jeremy, Donald Trump as a candidate had talked about restricting immigration and refugees, a Muslim ban at some points, and we have these executive orders restricting immigration from seven Muslim-majority countries, limits on refugees, postponement of refugees. What do you make of that when it comes to the message it sends countries around the world?
Well, I think it's part of this 1930s-style move of trying to build walls and closing ourselves off to what we see as dangerous currents in the world. I think that when the president talks about carnage, he's talking about carnage abroad as well as at home. And the message it sends to the world is not just a message of non-cooperation. I think it's a message of hostility because we are so deeply connected to the business and education and daily interactions of people in so many other parts of the world that closing ourselves off to them is a hostile act. It's not just an act of non-cooperation. And I think that looks aggressive to people overseas, even our friends.
I want to focus in on the impact on Iraq for just a moment. There's been reaction there. People who have fought in some ways on our behalf against ISIS, worried that they can't come over to the U.S. And then there's this from a speech to the intelligence community officials after Donald Trump was inaugurated. Here's a listen.
Do you remember I always used to say, keep the oil? I wasn't a fan of Iraq. I didn't want to go into Iraq. But I will tell you, when we were in, we got out wrong. And I always said, in addition to that, keep the oil. Now, I said it for economic reasons. But if you think about it, Mike, if we kept the oil, you probably wouldn't have ISIS because that's where they made their money in the first place. So we should have kept the oil. But okay. Maybe you'll have another chance. But the fact is, should have kept the oil.
So we should have kept the oil from oil fields in Iraq. What do you worry about what Iraqis will hear from that?
Well, this is a hard one for me to comment on, Rob, because it's just such a stupid statement all the way through, and I don't say that lightly, but it is a stupid statement. First of all, we don't have a shortage of oil right now. Keeping the oil is not something we need to do. Secondly, if we were going to keep the oil, we would have been fighting much harder. He blames us for getting involved in the war that he himself supported, but if we were trying to keep that oil, we would have had to send far more soldiers over there. it's not that easy. You can't just say, the oil is mine. We've seen how hard it is to control these areas. And then third, your point, Rob, if we're trying to get people to cooperate with us and we're stealing their stuff, it's pretty hard to build cooperation. So that kind of statement is so damaging because it distorts everything that was going on. There is nothing correct in that statement. There is nothing absolutely even close to intelligent in that. And it just takes us off in the wrong direction, harming ourselves and harming everyone.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Linda is with us in Holcomb. Linda, hi.
Hi. I have a question in regards to the ban of last weekend. My understanding is that these people who have already been vetted for 18 months to 24 months, I'm wondering what President Trump is doing further to vet these people. I mean, is anything being done?
Linda, thanks for that call.
So, already been...
Yeah, talking about refugees in particular being vetted for 18 to 24 months, Jeremy.
So as I understand it, they hadn't figured that out yet. But I think what's happened so far is that those who had been vetted for 18 to 24 months, if they were from one of the seven countries where they were prohibited entry, they couldn't come in. And if they were deemed a refugee, they couldn't come in because of the halt to all refugees from all places. Now, after the court order on Friday night, I believe refugees are now coming in, those that have been vetted. We've gone back with the court order to where we were before the executive order was issued. What will happen if the executive order is reinstated by the courts? I don't know. What I've been told, Linda, is that people in Homeland Security didn't know what they were doing either. There was no planning for this. So they're kind of making it up as they go along.
Linda, thanks for the call. Chris joins us next in Columbus. Chris, hi.
Hey, I got to say I was not a fan of Trump during the election, but the actions that he's taken, broad policy-wise, I mean, implementation could be better, are spot on and what we needed. I think that we needed to address things from a, you know, what is best for our country, and that was not done previously.
Chris, thanks for the call. And Jeremy, that's the case the president is making. We need to have America first and foremost in our minds in foreign policy.
So I appreciate Chris's point, and I think there have been many things prior Democratic and Republican administrations did that did not serve the best interests of our country, and that would include some of the policies of President Obama. So I'm all on board with that. But I think the way we have to talk about this is by first having a real discussion about what our interests are. And our interests are not in putting a wall on the Mexican border. That hurts all of us. Our interests are not in putting a 20% tariff on everything we buy from Mexico. That's just a tax for all of us. Our interests are not in antagonizing our allies. Our interests are not in allowing Vladimir Putin to continue genocidal behavior in Syria and to move in and take over Ukraine and then move into the Baltics and other places. Our interests are not in a war between China and Japan or China and Taiwan. So I'm all for putting ourselves first. But I think we have to be clear about what our interests are. I fear, and I wrote this in the piece you quoted, Rob, that we're not actually pursuing our interests. We're pursuing our enemies. Those are two different things. Trump is lashing out at people he doesn't like, and that's different from pursuing your interests. You get into a lot of trouble, Democrat or Republican, when you want to fight your enemies rather than protecting your interests.
Chris, thanks for the call. We're going to Jerry calling from Iowa. Jerry, hi.
Hi.
What do you think, Jerry?
Talking to you today. I think on Trump's foreign policies, he's doing a great job. We've lost a lot of respect over the years, and I think with time we get some of that back. They've kind of run over us the last 8 years, and we kind of need to get some of that respect back and get our jobs back. And for the refugees, the articles that I read, there's only a few that aren't making it across, and they're the what I would call the iffy ones. And everybody else has been able to come through. It's not as big a deal as what everybody's making of it, is what I've read.
All right, Jerry, thanks for the call. So his main point there initially, Jeremy, Donald Trump will get more respect for the United States if Jerry feels we've lost.
So I appreciate Jerry's points, and I 100% agree with Jerry that respect and credibility matter. We have benefited for the last 50 to 70 years from the fact that, especially when our enemy was the Soviet Union, most people would prefer to have worked with us. And I think that's still true with regard to the United States and our rivalry with China in certain areas. They prefer us. They find us more credible, more trustworthy, more respected. And there were things that the Obama administration did that probably diminished the respect of the United States around the world. So I agree with Jerry on that as well. Where I disagree with Jerry is I think, and I'm certain, in fact, that the things President Trump has done so far have greatly diminished the respect of the United States around the world. And I will tell you that already we're seeing a decline in the number of talented people who want to come to the United States. Now, on the refugee issue, there are lots and lots of refugees who, under the executive order, if it's reinstated, whether they're iffy or not, in Jerry's terms, will not be allowed in the United States. My father was a refugee. Many of us have parents who were refugees. We wouldn't be here if we had an order like the order President Trump has initiated. That's not how you rebuild respect in the world.
Thanks for the call, Jerry. We're talking to Jeremy Suri, historian at the University of Texas, Austin, looking at Donald Trump's foreign policy. As far as just the day-to-day diplomatic relations, and we've seen a tiff with the leader of Mexico, not surprising, the leader of Australia. Do you think that some of these rifts are just early days in the White House, or do you think that there's some deeper significance here?
Oh, I think it's a little bit of both, Rob. I mean, I think their transitions are even under the best of circumstances rough, and people don't know each other. They're feeling each other out. Things can be misinterpreted. So I think we do need to give some leeway there. But I also think you have to value the relationships. And where it's hard for anyone, it doesn't just have to be Donald Trump, but anyone who has not operated in this space before, is it's difficult to understand the relationships and understand where the difficult points, where the sensitive points are. I hope that Secretary of State Tillerson will be helpful here. He has a lot of experience in international business and affairs, and I think that could be helpful. That's not the experience Donald Trump has had, and I think that's been a problem early on, but that could be improved. So I remain hopeful in that area.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Jeremy, worst case, if we really do go back to a 1930s international mentality?
Well, I fear, and I think there's a high probability of this, and I don't say this wanting it to happen. I hope I'm wrong, but I think there's a high probability we will be at war in the next year to year and a half, not nuclear war, but a big war, and we will not be happy about that.
We'll leave it there for now. Jeremy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Jeremy Suri. He's professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He's co-editor of the book, The Power of the Past, History and Statecraft. We have a link to his article on foreign policy in the Trump administration. You can find that linked over on the Central Time Facebook page. And while you're there, you can answer some of the questions we've brought up over the course of this conversation. Do you like or are you worried about the foreign policy course we've seen so far from President Trump and his administration? What do you think about particular issues like relationships with Russia, with Mexico, the wall there, the policies on immigration and refugees, our relationship with and funding of NATO, our alliance there? What are your hopes and your fears for Trump foreign policy in the coming years? Again, head over, read more at the Central Time Facebook page, and then share your thoughts there. And as always, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR, or if you're old-fashioned, send us an email to talk@WPR.org.
If you were awake at around 1:30 this morning, maybe still getting over the Super Bowl excitement, you might have seen a big bluish-green fireball streaking through the sky.
People from Wisconsin and from Illinois, Michigan, Indiana, Minnesota, Iowa, Ohio, New York, and Ontario reported seeing that last night. There are a lot of videos online from police dash cams and a UW observation facility.
So according to the National Weather Service, it was a meteor, and a flashy one at that. There were reports in Oshkosh and elsewhere of a sonic boom along with this light show.
The meteor went from the southwest to the northeast, either burning out over Lake Michigan or making a splashdown in the lake between Sheboygan and Manitowoc. I was sound asleep.
Totally missed it. I wish to have an executive order that says have these things happen at dawn or when I'm awake. I feel so left out.
I don't know if we have control over that, Kate. and I don't know that they can predict a big flashy one. I love going out when there's a meteor shower going around and trying to catch them.
Yeah.
When it's dark enough, when you're in the right place, it's
kids
not a full
moon.
Kids
love them. Yeah. I know. And I totally missed it.
If you happen to have seen or maybe even heard the Lake Michigan meteor that I just decided we'd call it, send us a note at the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.